What we know today as family court started more than 100 years ago as juvenile court. It was a progressive reform referred to as the Great Idea. In the years since, the scope of that system has grown a lot, today having a hand in the foster system, custody disputes, child protection, and more. It affects millions of people, but has largely escaped scrutiny. Our next guest says the system is doing more harm for families than good, and it needs to be replaced with something else. We want to hear from you in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one been involved with family court for juvenile justice, foster care, adoption, or something else? What was the experience like? What do you think needs to change? And do you work in the family court system? If so, what do you see working and what's not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jane M. Spinnick is a clinical professor emerita of law at Columbia Law School. She specializes in juvenile justice, child advocacy, and family court reform. Her new book is called The End of Family Court: How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. Jane, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Can you bring us back to the beginning when the idea was juvenile court? What was that system meant to address when it started?
The juvenile court began at the beginning of the 20th century, actually 1899 in Chicago, where the first court was founded. And the idea of the court was that a benevolent judge, using informality and a lot of discretion, would help families and help children, so-called fix them, in a social court. So a place that really didn't have much due process. The judge and maybe a probation officer or a social worker would try to figure out why a child was getting into trouble or why a family couldn't take care of their children and try to problem solve, try to fix what was wrong. I think it's important to recognize that at the time this was going on in the major cities of the Northeast and the Midwest, where millions of immigrants, most of them impoverished, were flooding into the cities. And so the families that the court intended to fix were not the earlier white settlers, but these immigrants who came from Southern and Eastern Europe, had very different customs, culture, language, approaches to life, and were deeply impoverished. And so many of the reformers believed that what they needed was to be made into, quote, proper Americans, and saw the court as one of the ways to do that, particularly when things were particularly bad for a family. So some of the ideas that the reformers had, like kindergartens and libraries and settlement houses, all had quite a positive spin to them. But the juvenile court, though it was set up to fix them, was often seen by the immigrants as punitive.
And how do we get from the point where it was a juvenile court system to what it is now, handling so much of family business and family life? How does it change into family court?
Well, it takes almost a century to do that. At the beginning, the kinds of cases that came into the family court were not so different than the kinds that come in today. The difference really was that the court itself didn't see a difference. So when children might have broken the law, what we call juvenile delinquency, when children get into trouble, but they haven't really broken the law, they've just misbehaved, and because they are under 18, they can still be brought to court. That was part of delinquency at the beginning, and now it is a separate category of young people called status offenses. The status is their age. And then what was called then dependency, and we now call neglect and abuse. So the court dealt with those kinds of issues and also dealt with issues concerning custody, paternity, support. And over time, as these different areas of law became categorized separately and different causes of action, the court continued to expand so that today it encompasses, in most jurisdictions, all of those issues. In some jurisdictions, also divorce and other matrimonial issues.
And you mentioned something earlier, due process. And I was really surprised to read in your book that in the early years of juvenile court, family court, it was acknowledged by some that due process wasn't really compatible with what they were trying to do. Can you talk about that idea of due process and what it's looked like over the years in the court?
Sure. There was no due process in the early court. The whole idea was that either the child or the parent was exchanging this benevolent help for what would otherwise be, at the time, due process in another court. Over the course of the century, as people began to recognize that this court was not achieving what it was supposed to be achieving, which was to diminish juvenile delinquency and recidivism, help families. And when it wasn't doing that in that way, there was much more concern that this bargain that had been made was not really occurring, and that maybe young people and their families needed more due process. By the 1960s, when the Supreme Court was really looking hard at due process for both adults and young people, it began to scrutinize the juvenile court a great deal. And the classic example of that is a case called In re Galt, where a young child, really, a 14-year-old, Gerald Galt, allegedly made a lewd phone call without any due process, not a lawyer, not witnesses, not even notice of what the charges were. He got sent to the Arizona Reform School for 6 years. Fortunately, there was an ACLU lawyer in Arizona in the 1960s who got the ACLU to take that all the way up to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court, Justice Fortas in particular, really railed at this court for providing young people with absolutely no chance to prove that they had not done what they had been charged with doing, and that essentially the court was the worst of both worlds. It was neither benevolent nor was it providing due process. So that was the beginning of what came to be called fundamental fairness in juvenile court and later in the expanded family court, where young people were given many more, though not quite all, the due process rights that adults had. Unfortunately, while that is what was supposed to happen, as recently as during the Obama administration, there were many studies done by the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, finding that many juvenile and family courts remain stuck in the pre-Galt era, giving very little due process to young people, and really almost forgetting that that was their obligation. And so many jurisdictions ended up coming under federal mandates to provide counsel to young people, to make sure they had the rights they're supposed to have. And these were only in places where the administration saw very clearly what the problems were. But there are many places around the country where this continues.
We're talking with Jane M. Spinnick right now, a clinical professor emerita of law at Columbia Law School, talking about her new book, The End of Family Court, How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. You can join in, too, with your questions, your comments, your experiences with the family court system at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. We continue our talk with Jane M. Spinnick from Columbia Law School about her new book, The End of Family Court, How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families. And Jane, you write in the book that when you started in on this book, you didn't think about, you didn't plan on saying that the court should be abolished. Where did you start to change your mind? What is it about the family court system that you think needs doing away with?
Well, what you're right. When I started, I really did believe that the court could be made into a better version of itself. I kept thinking that with less discretion for the judges and more due process, maybe it could work well. There were a few things that changed my mind. The first was digging down into the history of the court over about 125 years now, and seeing that the kinds of problems we face in the court today are the same kinds of problems that were faced throughout the history, often with the same solutions proposed and then rejected. So it has always been a court for poor people. It increasingly became a court disproportionately for people of color, especially Black, and later in the century, Native Americans. And early on, really very early on, even supporters of the court, but often also scholars outside of the court, began identifying that many of the issues that the families had could be solved in their communities, that they did not have to be brought into court, that so much of what brought them into court was their poverty, the segregated communities they lived in, the lack of housing, of proper child care, of good schools, many of the same things we say today. But those concerns were consistently answered by the court itself, especially the judges, as, well, society's never going to do that, so they're better off coming into court. And if you just give us some more resources and you give us more judges, we'll fix those problems. But the truth is, the court has never been able to do that. The suggestion that more resources and more judges would make a difference has been proven wrong over and over again through this century. There were lots more resources and lots more judges, and it hasn't helped the families. It has really drawn out from the community resources that might have made a difference if the community could themselves have helped to develop the kinds of supports and mutual aid that could support families when they especially needed it. The other thing that really changed my perspective was in the last two decades, there has been an increasing advocacy by impacted families and youth, parents and young people with lived experience in the juvenile legal system, in the family regulation, what most people think of as the child welfare system, within the foster care system. There has been a lot of speaking out about the harm that has been caused to generations of families involved in these systems. And that advocacy has really helped me see my role as a professional in the system differently, as someone who really needs to listen hard to what these families are saying. And that has come kind of hand in hand with the idea that abolition is not just about tearing down or you know, letting people out of prison. Abolition is really a mindset about how we can support people better in ways that have not proven to be so punitive. How can we keep children safe in their families by supporting them in their communities? So all of those things came together for me, and it led me to look really hard at how this court could be shrunk and eventually eliminated so that the only cases that should be in court are those that are really legal cases. So, for example, I think it's important for your listeners to know that only about 20% of any of the cases that ultimately reach the family court in child protection are about serious harms to children, whether they're physical or sexual or you know, extreme neglect like starvation or the failure to give essential medical care. Everything else is either about poverty or other structural inequalities. So we investigate millions of children every year, and yet only about 500,000 of them ever even reach the family court. But those investigations, which are mostly screened out, are very disruptive to families and end up treating families in ways that make families unwilling to seek help because they are so afraid of being reported, even if those reports never become cases in a court. They undermine the ability of parents or young people to trust people like their teachers, like their doctors, like their other healthcare workers. And so we actually undermine helping families by having a massive system that doesn't actually keep children safe or keep them happy and healthy in their families.
It is a massive system. One stat that you wrote about that really drove it home for me was that 1 in 3 children nationwide and over half of Black children will experience a child protection investigation by the time they reach 18 years old. I mean, that's a pretty stark number.
It's a ridiculous number. And as I just was discussing, most of those investigations are terribly disruptive. They scare people, of course, but most of them don't end up in finally reaching the court. And so, nor do they end up with providing the services that these families need. And yet we spend about, at last count, about $34 billion on these systems, almost half of which goes for out-of-home care for those numbers of children who eventually reach court and are placed away from their families. Mm-hmm. If we took that $15 billion and spread it around in communities, it is much more likely that children will be safe within their families. Because as we found during the worst of the pandemic, when impoverished families get more money and they don't have to worry as much about evictions and they get some mutual aid from their communities, there was less less findings of abuse and neglect during that period of time.
Yeah, and, so I am curious, Jane, sorry to interrupt, but in our last minute or so here, if the court would be shrunken, would be done away with, what do you imagine kind of taking its place?
Well, the biggest thing that will take its place is community-based services, where most people can get the supports they need, whether it's substance use treatment, mental health, regular health treatment, better funded schools. All of these things would make a huge difference. For those small number of cases that still have a legal issue that we want people to have due process for, they can be part of our current judicial system without having a separate court that still believes it's doing good. At least the other courts in the system recognize that at best they're doing some justice, but they're not pretending that they're doing good.
Well, Jane, thanks for sharing this with us today and taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Jane M. Spinnick is a clinical professor emerita of law at Columbia Law School. She specializes in juvenile justice, child advocacy, and family court reform. We've been talking with her about her new book, The End of Family Court: How Abolishing the Court Brings Justice to Children and Families.